So I'm here in my lovely living room. Which, apologies about the weird camera angle. I would be recording at my kitchen table, except there's a hole in the floor through which you can hear my neighbors blasting LBC all day. So,
for our majority American audience, would you mind telling them what LBC is?
LBC is the right wing talk radio.
Yeah, okay. Hi, James.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good, thank you. Why don't you tell the folks at home a little bit about who you are and what you've been working on this week?
Cool. So I'm James, and I do various web and open sourcey stuff with Ruby and JavaScript mostly. Recently, I have just wrapped up working on a project where I have rebuilt Git in Ruby and written about it, and that's resulted in a book that I've just published. And yeah, the idea is that we walk the reader through rebuilding this tool that they use every day in a high-level language that sort of teaches them the concepts involved in a sort of more accessible way than actually going and reading the original source code.
Yeah, because like this is actually like a thing that I thought was really interesting, is that like when you approach this, right, there are many different ways that you could think about like how Git works, right? There's like the operations that you as a programmer perform, there's like the C source code, there's what's actually represented in the file system. And like, I was wondering like how you began to unpack all of that and like why, like, yeah, what, like, what was your approach to actually learning how to build Git so that you could teach other people how to build Git?
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So one of the problems with Git is there's a certain amount of accidental complexity to it that makes it hard for people to understand. Like, people are often told that like to use it properly, you have to know how it works inside, which is sort of a design failure. And some of the user interface is strictly more complicated than the functionality that it is providing an interface to. But yeah, like sort of early on, you can get a pretty good grasp of what it's doing just by like looking at the files. So like when you run git init and git commit and git add, you will see it generate a bunch of files, and most of them are sort of text files, and you can just read them and see what they are. Some of them are binary formats that you need to look at the documentation for. So like when you run git add, that stores off a copy of the file in the object database, and it'll be compressed, but if you just like decompress it with zlib, you can see what it is.
Right. So
there's a certain amount of just like poking around at the files it generates and looking at its documentation and just, you know, trying to map one to the other.
Right. And so when you were doing that, you were running your normal Git workflow and just being like, what changed in this .git directory? Let me go learn what that change actually means according to the Git documentation, and then just sort of repeating to build up some idea of how it's working under the hood.
Yeah, pretty much. Especially for like what it is storing as a result. There are some other things where, like especially the stuff that you use early on, is just commands that store stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, add and commit basically just add stuff to the storage in different ways.
Right.
The later stuff is more like things like the log command or, like, checkout and merge are... You can look at what they're doing on disk, but there's a bit more to, like, how are they actually extracting information that you can't see just by reading the files. And in that case, you want to go and dive into the source code a bit more.
Gotcha. And so you started just by exploring through the like Git object database on the file system. And then eventually, I'm guessing you had to pop open the C source code of Git. When that happened, what was it in particular you were trying to wrap your head around? And like, how was digging through the C source code of Git?
That's an interesting question. I came to this having learned C very recently. Like, it's the first substantial C code base that I tried to read.
Okay.
And I tried to only resort to reading the source code when, like, either when I didn't have an idea of my own about how something might work, or when I was trying to confirm an assumption. You can get quite a long way by just, like, looking at the files on disk, maybe using strace to, like, especially for stuff like status and checkout and things, you can, like, look at how it's accessing files and infer what it's doing.
Gotcha.
And using the documentation. But for a few things, I was like for a lot of those things, you can look at how it's accessing files and come up with a sort of like reasonable design for how to do that. But for other things, it's not so obvious.
Right.
And then you want to sort of dive into, like, well, what algorithms are they using to do this?
That's really interesting. So, like, basically, it sounds like a lot of the work that you were doing is you just treated Git as if it was almost total black box and sort of reverse engineered how it works from, like, visible operations. I guess strace there, you're looking at which files it's accessing and what it's doing with those files, but not actually at a source code level, rather at a, like, syscall level. So that's a really interesting approach. Did you find that by the time you came to the source code that having done this first gave you a much better understanding of what Git was doing, or were you very deliberately trying not to go source code first? Like, what was your motivation there?
It was a mixture of, like, what I knew how to do and what some things that I wanted to convey to the reader. Like, one of the skills that I wanted to sort of get across was, like, kind of a set of debugging skills, I suppose. Like, I wish I could remember the name of this talk, but there's a talk I frequently share with people about, like, using strace to debug anything.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, if you Google that, you'll probably find the thing that I'm talking about. And I have used it occasionally to go, like, so, like, a common thing you could do with strace is, like, just take the error output of, like, say you're hitting a web service and you're getting, like, it's spewing an error at you. Like, it's telling you a file doesn't exist, or it's giving you a certain error message. Like, sometimes you can, because the error message will have been written to a file somehow, standard output or a socket or something. If you could go and look at strace for what that process is doing and see, like, what's happening just before that, you can find that error because you can find where it's being written to a file and look at what's happening before that. And then you could go, oh, it was trying to access this file and it got an error. So, like, that's why it crashed. So sometimes looking at things at a system call level will tell you, like, well, I don't know anything about how this works internally, but it clearly crashed after trying to read this thing.
Right. Yeah, it's really funny, actually. In the previous episode that you haven't heard because it's not out yet, we were talking about Sean is debugging a crazy memory leak in crates.io, and he's been using similar syscall tooling as well as Valgrind to, like, attempt to debug his program. And so, like, it's really interesting to me how, like, there's a bunch of these Unix-y standard tools that we can use to know lots about what our programs are doing without necessarily ever having to read inside the source code. And I like, as well, I think, from a sort of, like, teaching method, that, like, we're going to spend as much time as we possibly can resisting having to read any C source code. probably, like, makes the book a bunch more approachable. Sure.
Yeah. So, like, even though I did use the source code for researching, like, a fair amount of it, there's a few places where, like, I'll link to bits of the source on GitHub.
Okay.
Although that is actually mostly linking to comments to go, like, well, these are the rules for what a valid branch name is or something. There's very few places where I actually talk about the C code directly. And that's partly to do with, like, a thing that I wanted to do with this was, like, although it is ostensibly a book about Git, I wanted to get a lot of transferable information. Sort of use it as a vehicle for learning a bunch of different computer stuff.
Right.
And some of that stuff is, like, you know, how do you inspect what is going on your computer or what a program is doing? So using things like strace and hexdump to look at files and, like, not that those are, like, reading the Git source code is might teach you some stuff about reading C source code.
Right.
But I thought there's, like, more transferable value in, like, how do I just find out what, like, any random program is doing?
Yeah, I really like that approach because it's sort of like it's demystifying computer things to some degree, right? It's like,
yeah.
Because I'm about a chapter and a half in because you only released it this week and I've been busy, but, like, I really enjoyed the way you immediately went into this is a zlib compressed file. If we hex dump it after we've decompressed it, and then we can see, like, what's in it. And I was like, oh yeah, that's like chaining together a bunch of things that I, like, know how to do in programs, but would never have, like, intuited is the way that Git is storing stuff on disk. And so it's like, it's a really good teaching example to be like, when you see a scary thing you don't understand, you can usually debug it out. I've actually used very similar tooling in cases where, like, I hit a web server and with curl and I get back what looks like absolute nonsense until I realize that it's gzip compressed, even though I didn't ask for gzip compression, and then, like,
yeah.
And stuff like that. So yeah, I think that's a really interesting approach. I guess, like, this is now the second book that you have to your name. And like one thing that has really stood out to me is the clarity of your explanations and understanding throughout. Is there like an approach that you have when building books like this to make them really easy and understandable?
I'd love to say there was. I'm not sure that I have like a recipe per se for like, I just have a bunch of writing habits
okay.
that result in things that some people find easy to read.
Uh-huh.
And I might not be totally conscious of what those are. There's a lot of it was, I think like trying to plan out this book was like trying to figure out a dependency order. So a book that I read a couple of years ago was, I'm sure like lots of other books do this, but it's the first time that I'd seen it. The book Types and Programming Languages has like, after its table of contents, has a dependency graph of all the chapters.
Right.
So it's like, if you don't want to read this entire thing, but you're particularly interested in this bit, here are all the prerequisites. And I didn't produce something exactly like that for the reader to see for this book, but I was trying to think in terms of like, well, okay, how do we sort of topologically sort the features? Because like you'll do stuff like go, there's a bunch of machinery inside the merge command that relies on stuff that you'll build for the log command and the checkout command and the diff command. And so like, well, you do those first.
Right.
And then like you've got a bunch of machinery you can reuse for later bits. So it's sort of, yeah, trying to order it so that both you're introducing features as they make sense, but also each feature is the sort of smallest amount of work possible because you already did half of it
right
earlier, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And so that you don't like, so basically like you don't have to, you're teaching on top of things that you've already taught, right? So it's like you're not having to invent the universe in order to like take any big leap. So it's almost a little bit like how we imagine software projects should be developed, except that
right.
that's not how that ever actually happens in the real world, which is I guess one of the nice things when you have the ability to reorder your text and edit over and over again is like coming up with that. That's yeah, that's really cool. So I guess then, so you start with this amorphous goal of like, I'm going to build Git, and then you started with the object database and the add and commit commands. I guess following on from that, what was like, was there anything in there that was like particularly difficult to understand and implement?
The thing that I think required the most amount of research and prototyping and revisions was like the third part about, So the third part of the book is about distribution. So like, we talk about loads of stuff that just happens on your local machine, which is mm-hmm. everything about making commits and branching and merging and conflicts and all of that stuff. And then the final part is about, well, like, how do you actually send this stuff over the network so you can collaborate with people? And that is both, like, that was the hardest thing to do sort of incrementally. It's like, okay, well, I've got all this stuff, but now I want to do the fetch command. There are like several chapters of stuff before you actually get a fetch command because it just requires a lot of machinery. There's a lot of like file formats to implement and like stuff for launching processes on a remote machine and talking to them. And
right.
So that was both like, because I didn't know how any of that worked in advance, it was really hard to sort of plan out, oh, well, I'll do that and that and that. I had to just like build quite a lot of prototypes of it before I understood it well enough to like break it into reasonable pieces.
Yeah.
And that also required the most amount of, I think, like combination of reading the documentation for those file formats, but also the source code, because some of the documentation is a little bit ambiguous about like exactly how this one number is encoded or something. But also stuff like, okay, well, I get that this is how you represent compressed objects in these like pack files that you're sending around, but like, how do you decide how to compress them? Like, how do you find all these pairs of objects that might compress well against each other? So like, that was a fair amount of, reading the source code to find out like how it actually optimizes that stuff.
That's really interesting. I guess my understanding is that pack files are basically like, instead of Git having to send you lots of tiny files when you do a pull, it sort of like globs them all together so that you can do one very large, very efficient network transfer. And then like, is the file format some way optimized to allow like Git to also work quickly on disk? Or does it then unpack it into the like more normal format on the disk?
Right. So there's two sort of separate things there. One is like, how do you send a load of objects over the network quickly?
Right.
the simplest way to do that, which is the first thing that I implement, is like imagine that you take all of the files out of the objects directory and you just concatenate all of them.
Uh-huh.
And you just send that all of that over the network. That's effectively what's going on. Okay. And each of those objects is individually zlib compressed. So it's almost like just running the cat command over the objects you've selected and sending that over the network. And because it's the protocol doesn't request each object at a time, so you're not doing a round trip. It's more like the client goes, these are the commits that I want, and these are the commits that I already have. And then the server works out from that, okay, well, these are the set of commits I need to send you to complete your picture of the history. And then it will bundle up all the objects that those commits contain and then just concatenate all of them and send you them. The optimization that you can do on top of that is like a lot of those objects will have similar content, like there'll be subsequent versions of the same file.
Right.
And so you can take advantage of that to compress it. Even though each object is zlib compressed, you could take advantage of those similarities between objects to compress them even further. So that's when you see Git going on about like resolving deltas. Like a delta is a thing where one object has been written essentially as a sort of binary diff against another object. And that, for objects that are similar, tends to result in them being like a huge compression gain, like over 90% on most objects that are compressed that way.
That's really interesting. So that format then, it sounds like, is not actually efficient for on-disk usage, which is why Git then is like processing, like once that's come back and it's resolved all its deltas, like it's actually spitting objects back out onto the file system as if they were not packed together? Or does it store the packed file locally and then you work out of that?
So it depends if the like everything. So on the other end, on the receiving end, it can do either of those things. It can either like split it back out into individual object files, or it can keep the pack. Like usually if you go and clone a big repository, you'll just end up with one pack file on disk that contains the entire history. So for like small amounts of data, like if you're sending like less than 100 objects, it will split the pack out into individual files again. But for more than that, it'll just keep the pack file, and it will generate an index of, because what you want to be able to do is like locate any object at random inside that pack.
Right. Right.
So you need to know where every object begins. So it generates an index for that. But it also, when it's generating the pack, it does take into consideration like what will make the pack quick to read off disk. And this is much more important when SSDs were less prevalent.
Right.
Because like seek times were like a huge expense. But it will do stuff like, firstly, it will tend to be that if you have a pair of objects and you've compressed one against the other, it uses a bunch of heuristics that means that usually the newer object will be left as is and the older object will be turned into a delta. So that means that like accessing recent objects is less expensive.
Oh, whereas interesting. Accessing
older objects means that you might need to resolve a chain of deltas to get, because you're more frequently accessing recent objects and older objects. So there's actually a file, there's like a sort of annotated transcript of an IRC session where they talk about this in Git's documentation to go like, could someone explain to me like why any of this is the case and why it's designed this way? Like I could send you a link to that. But
we'll put it in the show notes.
It's in the documentation bit of their repository, and I'm pretty sure it should be on the website, so I'll try and dig that out.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something folks can go read in the show notes for sure. When you say there's an annotated IRC transcript, this wasn't you rolling into that IRC and asking questions. This is a conversation happened many years in advance.
This is from like a decade ago. yeah.
Cool. But that's a really interesting design where they're like, we suspect 90% of the time people will want the most recent version of the file, so we'll compress everything that's old to save disk and network time. That's like a really intelligent and well thought out design choice.
Yeah. And like it tries to sort the objects in the pack so that objects that are connected to recent commits appear earlier. But then it also has to sort things so that the object that a delta is based on appears before it, because the thing that is scanning through the file needs to have read the base object before it can decompress the delta.
Yeah.
So there's sort of multiple conflicting constraints on how the stuff is ordered, but
Are they using any kind of like serious constraint optimizer to solve that, or is it just like a bunch of heuristics they've thrown together?
It's mostly like when it finds the pairs of objects to compress them, like it sorts them by type and size and name, and that puts things that are likely to be similar
right
next to each other.
Gotcha.
And then when it's writing them out, it just does a pretty simple like recursive like. Well, we'll do the commits in recency order, and then anything that are connected to those commits, like, except if you're about to write a delta, do a recursive call to make sure you've already written its base object.
Okay, gotcha.
So, like, it's not like it's a pretty simple, like, recursive sort of topological sort thing.
That's really cool. So, you ended up with a mostly, I understand it, fully compatible version of Git that, like, because you cloned both Ruby and Linux, right, to prove that, like, your Git works. So that's really cool. Is there anything that you're aware of that like is not compatible between, I guess, your Git and real Git?
So I think it's, I don't know which, whether it's like forwards or backwards compatible, which is the right terminology, but everything that Git generates is valid Git data.
Uh-huh.
So any repository you've written with Git should be readable by Git, but the I think any pack that Git will put on disk should be readable. The only thing that I'm not aware of is if you write data with Git that JIT can't read is the index. So Git has a bunch of index extensions. Like the index is the thing that stores all the files that are in the next commit.
Yeah.
And it has some extensions to that format, which I've not implemented.
Okay.
And it means that my parser will ignore that and then think the checksum is wrong, just because like those are sort of some micro optimizations that I wasn't especially interested in doing.
Gotcha.
But that, I mean, the index is something that like you can delete it and regenerate it from an existing commit, or it's sort of, you know, it's generated data. It's not sort of a primary source of information. So I didn't consider that a huge blocker.
Is the indexing in this case the thing where it's like storing which files you've Git added? Is it that index that you're talking about?
Exactly.
Okay, cool. Great. Is there anything else you'd like to tell the folks at home about the book?
You can get it if you write reviews on Goodreads. That'd be super helpful. And if you've read it, let me know what you think, because I'd love to improve it if bits of it could be improved. I've had some really good feedback so far, so it's really valuable to me.
Yeah, and I guess actually just before we wrap up, you chose to write this in Ruby, but like Ruby is sort of incidental to the book. Right?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Like you could do this in Node or Go or C++ or
yeah,
really any language. But I think basically the reason you chose Ruby is that it has a large built-in standard library that gives you everything you need without adding dependencies and like is fairly readable to everyone. Is that a fair summary?
It's definitely one of the reasons that like I knew I wanted this to be accessible to an audience. Like you have to pick some language
right
to do it in, but I didn't want to restrict the audience to that of any particular language.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that like yeah, I wanted it to be accessible to people who weren't familiar with using it. And that so the like the fact that Ruby comes pre-installed on macOS and is if you're on Linux, there's usually a package in the repos for that.
Right.
Like I didn't want so yeah, things that were like either pre-installed or very easy to install on the operating systems I'm targeting were appealing. But also like I didn't want people to be, you know, fighting with Ruby Gems or Bundler. I just want to be able to go like, here's all the code, you can run it. I don't want you to like faff around with like
any dependency
installation
management
problems.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I mean, both Ruby Gems and Bundler are pretty easy to get going on a Mac or a Mac or Linux these days, but
I just say like this is not a complaint about those tools. Like I use them every day, and like when you know how to use them, they work great.
Yeah,
but I have seen a lot of newcomers to Ruby be very frustrated with figuring out how to get them set up, and so
yeah, that's totally valid. Yeah, so for the folks at home, it's shop.jcoglin.com/building-git if you're interested in grabbing a copy of James's book, where he rebuilds Git from scratch in Ruby and teaches you a bunch of skills along the way. Yeah. So James, do you want to yell at me about Ruby auto formatting for like 15 minutes now?
I have been, so because I've just been catching up on your recent episodes. I really want to get into this. Partly because, like, it's a thing I try not to have opinions about.
Uh-huh.
Because I genuinely don't. I'm not someone who is interested in getting into fights about formatting with my coworkers. But I know that some people do care about it a lot, and you're putting a lot of thought into it, and
on team I don't want to get into a fight about auto formatting with my coworkers.
But have you? Because the thing is that I've genuinely not had this experience so far in my career of people having huge fights over formatting, and I assume that people who want these tools have done. Although I would say I've also worked at a shop that used RuboCop, and so that supposedly prevented that problem from occurring.
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? RuboCop, I think it's fair to say the problem is that RuboCop doesn't do a good enough job of stopping that argument from happening in the first place.
Sure.
And this is combined with a couple of things. I'm going to directly quote Justin Searles here when he says that the general unpalatability of RuboCop's defaults make it like very hard for teams to accept it, almost to the point where when you're starting a new project or starting a Ruby style guide for an organization, you are forced to have that fight. And then also because RuboCop is so configurable and that its configuration moves when you update RuboCop and when you update Ruby versions, you're sort of re-inviting that fight every time you upgrade your RuboCop Rails and Ruby versions.
Like every time you upgrade and you get new, you know, Ruby gets new syntax, you're like, what do we think about this one?
And you get new lints as well every time you update RuboCop. And so I'm taking a radically different approach to RuboCop with RubyFirms, which is there will be no configuration options that allow you to affect its style opinions whatsoever. Like, none. Which is what GoFirms does and the Elixir formatter does. And like, there's a bunch of precedent for this in other programming languages. And so like, I'm not the kind of person that likes to have these fights either, but I am the kind of person who one level up is desperately disappointed in the tooling that we have today, and was always sufficiently motivated. Well, I've been talking about this for several years, and then at RubyConf, Justin was like, I think I'm going to dig in and have this fight. And I was like, we cannot have the like Ruby auto formatter for all time be built on top of RuboCop. That's not to say that, like, RuboCop isn't a good piece of software, but it's, like, its scope is very large, and particularly with the, like, syntax auto-formatting bit, it's not super optimized for that specifically, and so with, like, RubyFirmed, it doesn't need, like, very much like JIT, it doesn't need any Ruby gems to work, and so you can run it with the disabled gem flag, and that means that, like, you can reasonably put it in your editor and not be annoyed at how long it's taking to snap your file into place, which, if you've ever programmed in Go, is a magical experience.
Yeah, that's actually a weird thing that I learned in this project, that I've been known for sort of bickering about how long it takes Rails to boot these days.
Uh-huh.
And now having written like a non-trivial command line program in Ruby, I'm like, I'm actually surprised at how quickly Rails boots, given how many thousands of times larger than my thing it is. But the thing that I wanted to dig into with like this idea that this thing is unconfigurable, uh-huh, and you have to talk about your decision process for like how we're going to legislate each thing that you decide to have an opinion about, right? Every syntactic form that you decide you are going to, like how you're going to render it. A thing that I found really interesting on a previous episode was that you talked about there are other languages that were specifically designed like syntactically to be easily amenable to tooling.
Yeah.
That Ruby didn't have an eye on that when its grammar was developed.
Sure.
And I don't know how much of that is to do with just the way its parse tree is represented is inaccessible, or the fundamentally the grammar itself is like far too amenable to being ambiguous, so that it's hard to have one way of formatting it that won't have really bad failure modes. Or is one of the things I've been frustrated with RuboCop recently is a lot of the rules that is introduced are like, when I run them over my code, it will tell me to make changes that will break my program. It will make my program behave differently. It's not just a formatting thing.
Yeah.
It will go, oh, you shouldn't use this method, you should do this other method. I was like, well, I picked this method because it does what I need, and the thing you're suggesting doesn't.
that's like a lot to unpack there, right?
So, yeah, so this is this huge ergonomics problem, and I'm really interested to see what you've learned about this.
So I will say that generally I've been told by people who have used RuboCop in more anger than I have that there are a lot of cops that have been contributed by some third-party author that had like a decent-ish justification at the time, were merged in, and then never really audited or maintained by the core RuboCop team. And so like I think to some degree, like where you have those frustrations where it will meaningfully change the semantics of your program, that is like something where RuboCop should have a higher quality bar on what its lints are doing. RubyFirmt hews in like hard the opposite direction, in that mostly speaking, the parse tree that comes in and the parse tree that goes out are identical. It's just
they only differ in layout.
Yeah, like so parentheses, like for example, it adds parentheses in places where you may not have put them, and sort of things like that, where like it's sort of minor stylistic differences. Broadly speaking, it is a bug. If like we would never rewrite a method or like reorder a case statement, like those are things that are far out of the concern of RubyFirmt. The in terms of like specifically designed tooling, I will say that dealing with the Ruby syntax tree is a fun exercise in learning how the language actually works in ways that I had never imagined. For example, the way like constant paths are expressions, and you can hang like you have an expression and then hang colon colon and then a constant path off it, and stuff like that.
Remember like a while ago finding out you could go like nil colon colon something, and that was the same as just writing the constant name.
Right. Well, but that's true for any class that inherits from object, basically, right? Like or any expression that returns an object that any expression, basically, you can do that, right? Yeah, so that's really fun. There are some things in Ruby, like for example, if you have an array, you can say like array literal a comma b star another array, and that will unpack the contents of that array into the array literal that you just created. Like,
oh yeah,
there are. You're like, I remember someone doing that once, and me thinking,
I use that all the time. Whereas, like, I found out, like, so I've been using Ruby for like 12 years, and I just learned this week that you can. You know the string interpolation syntax, the hash braces thing? If the thing inside the braces is a reference to an instance variable and nothing else, you can omit the braces. So you just go hash at name. And that is the same as writing hash open brace at name close brace. So and that also works for class variables and global variables. And I grepped all the code on my machine for that. It turns out a bunch of the library and gems use it, and I have never seen it before in my life. So I was wondering like what other arcane stuff. So you've now like internalized all of the Ruby grammar, which I believe like a you know infinitesimal percentage of Ruby programmers actually know all of its syntax.
Right. So yeah, I would say at this point I'm getting close to having seen every usage of Ruby. I didn't know about that one, which scares me because, like...
sorry.
Great. I'll write a test case for it. That one can't possibly be too hard to fix. But what that means by definition is that also works in a keywords array. So you can say percent capital W hash at foo. Oh, God. Anyway. Yeah, so the answer is, I would say Ruby's grammar is an exercise in creative parser design.
Yeah. It's like knowing how hard it is to parse on paper, I'm actually really surprised that people don't constantly run into edge cases in the grammar on a day-to-day basis. Like, there are all sorts of things where it's like, oh, if you write elif instead of elsif, it will treat it as a method call. Like, somehow people actually don't trip over that all the time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Anyway, basically the way I've done it is through sheer brute force. So I have two testing methodologies. So one is I write small fixture programs and I push them through, and I have a bash script that like says, the formatter formats them and it produces a valid Ruby file out the other end. And then the other executes the formatter over each file in RSpec's source code sequentially and then runs the test suite after each formatting execution. And so basically, like that doesn't work yet. As far as I can tell, the only major syntax construct that I have left to fix is HereDocs. And once that happens, I think I basically have a complete, like, it at least round trips Ruby programs correctly. There's a there's a difference between that and, like, is an auto formatter that anyone wants to use, right? But what's really interesting is there's
I found a really juicy thing about HereDocs the other day, which I need to tell you about.
Is that literally no one has ever done this exact thing before. Using Ripper, which is Ruby's built-in parser library, to emit a Ruby program. So Ryan Davis has done this with his Ruby parser gem, which re-implements the Ruby parser in a version-independent manner. So the Ruby parser gem, you tell it what version of Ruby you want it to parse, and it does that for you. But Ripper, right, is directly linking against the compiled Ruby parser of the version of Ruby that you're running, which comes with the advantage that you don't need to know. You just get a syntax tree out. But this also means RubyFirmed is tolerant of the syntax trees of every different version of Ruby that it supports, which is currently 2.3, 2.4, 2.5, and 2.6. The syntax trees changed significantly in each of those versions, actually.
Right.
Like, dealing with it isn't too complicated. The most part, it's a really interesting thing, for sure.
How much sort of branching is there in your project to just deal with different Ruby versions?
So there's actually almost no branching to deal with Ruby versions, but rather where the two syntax trees are different. So a good example of this is in Ruby's before, I think it was 2.4, you couldn't do a bare rescue inside a do block. Right, you had to say begin rescue end inside a do block, and then that changed. And the way that it changed is that method definitions, the thing inside them is called a body statement in the parser, and they just changed it so that a do block, instead of being a list of statements, was a body statement. And then a body statement contains an optional list of statements, and then rescue, else, ensure, and other statement lists, right? And then the syntax constructs for, also, I don't know if you knew this, but you can rescue else. So you can say rescue, and then if the rescue clause didn't execute, you can have an else clause that executes.
Right. I think I maybe knew that you could do that, but I've never imagined what I would use it for.
Yeah.
Like, I just write out the whole happy path and then, like, put the rescues at the bottom for various points that could go wrong. And
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, that's like Ruby trivia, for sure. I know so much about parsing Ruby now. It's like, yeah.
So, like, one thing that I learned recently, so Jet targets Ruby 2.3 and higher, just purely because that is available on most recent macOS and Ubuntu releases. But so before shipping it, I would run, like, to make sure that, like, all the commits made sense for the reader, I'd run the build on every commit on all the Ruby versions that I was targeting. And, like, that made me find, like, a few syntax differences I wasn't aware of. So, for example, I'd forgotten when they introduced the bare rescue in blocks thing. It turns out it wasn't in 2.3, so I couldn't use that. But one thing that I found out is that, you know, the tilde version of HereDocs?
Yeah.
Where you can indent the thing and it removes all the leading white space?
Yeah.
The semantics of that changed at some point. Somewhere between 2.3 and 2.6, the rules for whether and where it would remove leading spaces changed. So, like, until I changed how a bunch of stuff was... There's a bunch of things where, like, I had done some error messages by going, like, you know, double quote string literal plus line break another double quote string literal. I was like, oh, those should be HereDocs. So I replaced them with HereDocs and they stopped working on 2.3 or something because it preserved the white space for some reason. So this, like, even like things, it's not just we introduce new syntax, it's like we change the behavior of existing syntax. It's super fun.
Great. I haven't looked into that one yet. Now,
I'm sorry.
That's fine. Like, it's fine. It's fine. Most of these things are fine. Cool. Yeah, I guess, is there anything else you'd like to talk about or tell the folks at home?
I mean, I could fill hours grilling you on Ruby trivia, but I think I'll let you get back to your afternoon.
Show notes for this episode can be found at yakshave.fm/13.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any other, you can tweet us @_yakshave, email us at hosts@yakshave.fm, or leave a comment on the website.
Thanks for listening to the Yak Shave. We'll see you next time.